ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
All right, garage door's up. Toby's got the keys.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby, well, I've changed my trousers, so I feel a bit better now. Toby parked a car outside the building earlier on this evening. He said, come down. He said, I've got something that's, you know, a little bit unusual you might like to have a look at. And I went down. And, well, you better take up the story, Toby. What did I get into?
You got into a Porsche 911 Dakar. So so this is a 911. Most people know what a Porsche 911 looks like. And this one is, let's call it the off-road version. So it's actually jacked up a little bit in the suspension, and it's got obviously all-wheel drive. It's designed to do rally tracks, to do some rough road driving and so on. It's actually a nod to, if you go back to 1984, Porsche entered the Dakar Rally, the Paris to Dakar Rally, yeah. And they entered it in a 911. And this car, well, it went on to win the rally and did an amazing, had an amazing result. And so they've effectively recreated it. So it's, call it a rally car, basically a 911 rally car, and it's extremely cool.
It was extremely cool. It's fair to say it was extremely cool. Getting into it is a young man's game, though, I think, and getting out's even younger man's game.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's got bucket seats, and it's obviously pretty low.
You have to kind of tip yourself in and trust that you'll hit the bottom when you go in.
That's it. But it actually sits higher. It's 50 millimetres higher. It can go up to 80 millimetres higher than a regular 911. So you can get almost 200 millimetres of ground clearance out of it, which your average SUV, off-road SUV, is about 220, 230. So it's not too far off them. So it's pretty cool. It's got all-terrain tyres, which are designed to resist punctures and help you out on gravel, mud, sand, whatever. It's pretty cool.
What do you reckon it costs?
Well, it starts at around about 550 grand.
Oh, nothing. It's a
but
snap.
That one had the paint job on it from the original car. So it's designed to mimic that original race car paint job, which is about another 55 grand option. So so start saving. Well, actually, I think you can give up saving because they're all sold out. They're only doing 2,500 worldwide. Oh, so it's, pretty cool.
Anyway, it was very cool. It's something in our dreams. Anyway, look, on down back to the real world.
Yeah.
By the way, thanks. Yes, loud and clear on the app in Rome. Phil, I'm on Channel 25. That's okay too. Listening in ABC Sydney on the Listen app for Sid Don from Engadine. So that appears to be going okay. Anyway, any other problems, let me know. Tesla. Is Tesla in trouble? They're battling a lot of bad publicity.
Well, they're certainly under a lot more pressure than it's ever been before. I guess Tesla's had I guess you go back to 2017 or 18 when they were first building the Model 3, and that put them under pressure. But no, look, they're under pressure. They reported sales figures for the first quarter of this year were down for the first time in about 5 years, four years. Mm-hmm. So they had a struggle in terms of sales globally. They're still growing in Australia, still growing pretty strongly in Australia, but also had some issues with the Cybertruck. So this is that radical looking, sci-fi looking ute over in the States. So they've had a recall on that. Their margins are dropping because they're having to drop prices. So they're having to pull prices back to try and compete.
Because of China.
China, absolutely. Yeah. That's their main competition. But also mainstream brands are all starting to obviously put polar pressure on with EVs. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, look, it's a brand that is certainly feeling the heat. But keep in mind, they're still profitable. And they made $1.1 billion in the first quarter. So it's still a profitable car company. And per unit sold, they're still quite profitable. So,
interesting. Toby's website, by the way, evcentral.com.au. EV, that's for electric vehicle, central.com.au. If you want to know all the latest news about electric cars and any other questions, and you can ask questions of Toby too, advice@evcentral.com.au. Grant from Brisbane's been on the line. G'day, Grant.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm just calling regarding two issues. Number one is all the negative EV feedback that I see lately. Mm. I'd like to know the origin of it. And secondly, China's announcement of the new 1,000-kilometre solid-state battery vehicle.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the 1,000-kilometre batteries first. So there's a lot of car companies, and a lot of them Chinese car companies, and battery manufacturers talking up the 1,000-kilometre battery or the 1,000-kilometre electric car. You can theoretically do it now. You put a big enough battery in, you'll be able to do it. I don't think we're going to see a lot of these cars on the road. For the main reason being, batteries are the most expensive part of an electric car. So sure, they can go and put a 1,000-kilometre battery in, but how many people need that? And the answer is not many. Surely, yes, when you're potentially towing or, you know, off-roading or something like that, it may come in handy for that. For your average EV driving around town, very few people are going to need a 1,000-kilometre range.
I mean, I understand that, but it's the solid-state battery technology I'm speaking about, because the Japanese have been talking about it, the Americans have been alluding to it, but the Chinese just quietly bring it to the market.
Yeah. Have they got it to market in scale at the moment, though?
Actually, yeah, it's a production vehicle at the moment. Unfortunately, it's what they call a pseudo-solid-state battery, where they're actually using liquefied cooling. So it's... because there's always a problem with the dendrite formation with these batteries, that they've actually gone for the what you'd say the halfway mark, but it claims 1,000 kilometres and it's solid state.
Yeah, so. the other slight thing on the 1,000K range is, so there's various ways to measure range. The sort of the default for Australia is WLTP, the Worldwide Light Harmonised, whatever it is. And then we've got NEDC, which is the New European Drive Cycle, which is what our Australian design rules align to. You've then got the Chinese way. I can't remember it's CLC or something like that, but their way of measuring range, and it's notoriously inaccurate. So I would say straight away you could knock probably 150 Ks off that. But yeah, look, there's a lot happening with solid-state batteries. You talked about Japan in particular. Toyota and Nissan are two working very hard on solid-state batteries. General Motors is doing a fair bit with it. So there's a lot of brands, a lot of battery manufacturers working on those solid-state batteries. Everyone I've spoken to sort of says, yeah, you know, and keep in mind Mercedes-Benz had them in buses 3 or 4 years ago, solid-state batteries. So the technology's there. The challenge is making it in scale, making it affordably, and getting it on a mass-produced vehicle, which you might be right in terms of that China one, but I haven't seen them anywhere else in the world at this stage. But look, by the end of the decade, I think we'll start seeing more of that. You know, and as you say, China's the one leading the way on all this stuff. Like, in terms of battery technology, in terms of EV development, China is absolutely at the forefront.
Thanks, Grant. Yes. Good on you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Sophie says, Phil, question for Toby. Oh, hang on, now I've lost a question. Gee, I'm good. Question for Toby. I've got a 2006 Mazda 3 Max Sport with 117,000 Ks on the clock. I bought it new, always garaged. Not sure whether to hold onto it and switch to EV in the next 3 to 5 years or go for a new Mazda 2 sooner.
Yeah.
This is the kind of decision which a lot of people...
Yeah, a lot of people are thinking about.
A lot of people... This is the... You know, almost everyone right now is thinking of changing the car is in this kind of situation.
Yeah. All of those city hatchbacks, Mazda 2, Toyota Yaris, there's a raft of them that have all gone from being sort of $15,000, $16,000, $17,000 cars to now being $25,000, $30,000 cars. So they've all stepped up enormously in price. At the same time, you've got this price war happening in the EV market. Now, the cheapest EV currently on the market is $36,000, and you can get some decent ones for around about the $40,000 mark. So I guess where I'm going with that is you've got the prices of the petrol cars all creeping up. The EVs have been coming down due to basically pricing pressure, due to competition in the market. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. You're talking 3 to 5 years for buying one of these cars. We've got these fuel efficiency standards expected to come in next year. Still got to pass Parliament, but it's the feeling is they will. And those fuel efficiency standards are going to ramp up the influx of not only EVs, but hybrids, plug-in hybrids, but particularly EVs over the next few years. So I would say with your 2006 car with fairly low Ks on it for a car of that era, I'd be holding onto it and just watching what happens in the market over the next, even the next year or two, I think you'll see a fair bit of activity. Okay. So yeah.
Interesting. Can you comment on the Mazda CX-9 and CX-90? CX-90 is expensive. I'm wondering if the CX-9 is still a good buy if I can't stretch to the 90.
Yeah, look, a lot of people are thinking this. Mazda's going a premium strategy, so they're sort of shifting away from their affordable cars. You know, CX-8, discontinuing, CX-9, they're discontinuing, and they're shifting up to CX-60, CX-70, CX-80, CX-90. The reality is they are too expensive, and they're not selling in the numbers that Mazda had hoped for. The plug-in hybrids in particular, they haven't been engineered properly. The systems, the plug-in hybrid systems just don't work that well, so they're not particularly refined. and the ride quality on them in terms of comfort is just not really there. So they've got some issues with those cars. They've actually just announced a fix, I think it was on the CX-60, to try and make the ride better, make it more compliant. But I just think they're too expensive at the moment, those cars. They're playing in luxury territory, and you know, there's some elements of the car that are good, but they're nothing special. They are not what we've seen from Mazda for the last 20 years. So I'd either be going a CX-9 or consider some of its competitors. You know, a Nissan Pathfinder's not bad, for example, albeit thirsty. Kia Sorento, Hyundai Santa Fe, or if you need the next size up, Hyundai Palisade is excellent buying. So I would well be looking at those ahead of the CX-90.
Hmm. Okay. Vanessa in Cairns. Toby, just wondering what your thoughts are on the new Kia Tasman Ute.
Yeah.
That's arriving in 2025. Do you reckon ute drivers are going to want to change to this over a Hilux, Ranger, BT50, etc.? Are there any benefits to this over the other brands?
Well, we don't know a whole lot about it yet, other than the marketing campaign that they've started. And they obviously did that very clever ad with a whole bunch of Aussie sports stars and so on, which was amazing, some of the people they had in there. I mean, look, ultimately it will come down to the product. The car industry, I think, is fairly simple. If you get the product right, if you make the car, if you deliver on the brand promise and what people expect in that sort of vehicle, then absolutely you can come into that market and make an impact. And we've seen that, I guess, with Tesla coming in with electric vehicles. We've seen it with other cars in the past when they muscle in. The Ford Everest is a good example. You know, Toyota owned that off-road market. Ford came out with the Everest, did a terrific job with it. Guess what? People start buying it. So it'll be a relatively slow process. Kia's talking 20 to 25,000 sales annually for that car in Australia. The top sellers are up around 60,000, so your Rangers and Hiluxes. So they're not saying we're going to be a top seller from day one, but they want to be a significant player. But yeah, it'll all come down to the product. But, you know, Kia's done some terrific cars recently, and if they, I guess, do that same level of engineering and the same level of research, then you would imagine it it would come up all right. But we're not going to know that until maybe I'll get a look at it sometime in the next 6 or 8 months. But I think it's sort of mid-next year when it hits the market. And that's, you know, once we see pricing, once we see details, once we get behind the wheel, that's when you'll start to see whether it's got the credibility, got the substance to do what people expect in the ute segment.
Mm.
But that ute market's really interesting. I mean, keep in mind, Mercedes-Benz tried to come and take a chunk of that market. And they said, well, we're Mercedes-Benz. We've got the three-pointed star badge.
That's right.
They underdid it. They came out with
They redressed a Nissan Ute.
Yeah, that's right. So it was, and the market said, hang on, this is not what we want in a Ute. Yeah. And so if you don't deliver on what people expect, and as crude as Utes can be, there are pretty high expectations from them. People obviously, you know, number one is they've got to be reliable and tough and rugged.
Hilux and Ranger have changed the expectations about this, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. But then they've also, these days, you've got to have the technology.
Yeah.
They've got to drive reasonably well by ute standards. And you know, they've got to have comfort and safety and everything. So there are pretty high expectations on those vehicles. So it's so, you know, Kia would know that. They'll be coming in saying, we have to nail this, this, and this, and they will have given the engineers all the points they have to hit. But we won't know basically until the car hits the market.
Sure. Pauline from Maribyrnong. Hi, Pauline. Why can't I listen to Nightlife on ABC Melbourne on the app? I don't like football. I'm annoyed. No, I understand that, Pauline. If you try the app in another city like Sydney, I know this is a bit annoying if you're in Melbourne to do that, but try us on that. Try ABC Sydney. You'll find Nightlife. There we are here. And I understand why you're annoyed. Frankie Winthrop in WA has got the same problem on the app. We have to listen to AFL Dribble, he says. I can't find a separate Nightlife button. There's not a separate Nightlife button, but if you go to ABC Radio in another location, Frank, you should be able to get us. And apologies to this, because it probably should be a bit easier. We're still trying to work all of this out. Interesting, Jim says that the Kia went for the name Tasman, which was a Leyland model back in the 1970s.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Look, naming a car can be pretty tricky these days. And, you know, it seems like they wanted a local name, something with some Aussie heritage. And I think ultimately they sort of looked at that and said, well, there's not many people who would know that or remember that. And the people who do will probably forget about it pretty quickly. So I think they would have been considering a whole bunch of other stuff ahead of that. But
Grant from Cooperoo. G'day, Grant.
How you going, gents?
Not bad.
Question. These new EVs, the Kia and a Tesla in question, mate of mine's got a Kia as a work vehicle that's got a 3-kilowatt inverter built into it.
Mm.
And the Tesla, which is brother-in-law's vehicle, the air conditioning runs when the vehicle's just sitting there, so it keeps the car nice and cool at 22. What sort of battery consumption does that use?
Yeah, so some of them will actually tell you this. So the Kia thing you're talking about, Hyundai does it as well. A BYD does it. So it's called vehicle to load. So basically, you can sometimes they've got the Kias have got a plug in the car, so it's just a standard PowerPoint, 230 volt PowerPoint. The BYDs and the Hyundai and stuff, you've got to plug something into the charge port, and it just looks like a power board, basically, like a you know, you plug your appliances into that. And yeah, they usually go about 3.6 kilowatts, something like that, so they can power all sorts of stuff, coffee machines,
cooktops.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's a blackout, you can power your fridges and stuff, and that's a pretty cool feature. And the thing about Tesla running the air conditioning when the car's off, most EVs can do that. So most of them, anything with an app, like with a remote app where you can monitor the car, most of them you can get the air conditioning running and cool the cabin either ahead of time or while you're sitting in the car and waiting for it to charge or doing whatever. So yeah, it's one cool feature. In terms of the electricity use, so I was looking at this the other day on... I had an EV that was actually telling me the electricity use at the time, and it was around about, I think, 1.3 or 1.4 kilowatt hours per hour. So keep in mind the battery capacity on an EV is usually between about 50 and 100 kilowatt hours. So I guess you could run that air conditioner for, what, up to 60, 70 hours. Stay for a couple of days.
3 days.
Yeah. So it's...
Oh, wow, okay.
So, yeah, it'll certainly use electricity, but nothing like the electricity used to power the car. You certainly need a lot more energy to move the car than you do to cool it.
Hmm. Yeah, I figured that because my mate has got the Kias looking at when they bring in electric vans and setting up a camper as an off-grid camper, but I said to him, you want to be close to a power point to recharge it when it runs out because it's really hard to push start these things.
Yeah. Well, see, the other thing...
RACQ for a can of petrol.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's... you should be able to comfortably run them overnight for something like that. And I guess a lot of people doing that sort of thing, a camper van type thing, might end up staying in a caravan park anyway, so they'll have access to power pretty easily. So, it's not a bad feature of an EV, that.
Thanks, Grant. Good on you. 1-300-800-222. Some more text questions. We're looking to upgrade our 2014 Odyssey. We'd like a dedicated 7-seater minivan, but there are fewer and fewer models to choose from.
There are.
Considering a grey import from Japan, which have some great models, but obviously no factory warranty. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, in buying a grey import, you do...
Just explain what they are, by the way.
It's basically a private import. So it's a car that wasn't sold here. So it's available overseas, was never certified for sale in Australia.
That little cube, Nissan Cube, is an example.
Absolutely. So, and there's a bunch of people movers. There's a whole bunch of people movers that came into Australia. They got through a bit of a loophole, basically, by... You could do it to convert camper vans, and the people would go through that whole camper van conversion paperwork and then get them here and just say, oh, no, we decided not to turn it into a camper van now. So they'd land the cars and then not bother converting them into camper vans. But I think they've closed that loophole now. So, grey imports, the positives, they're generally cheaper, so you generally get something that's a bit cheaper. The negatives, if it's got a Toyota badge, a Nissan badge, whatever it might be, you can't necessarily buy the parts for that thing in a Toyota or a Nissan dealership, so they won't stock the parts. When there's a recall, you can't go back to the Toyota or Nissan dealer because they did not sell the car in Australia. Someone else imported it to Australia. So you have to make sure you got all those things covered off. And the other thing is, you know, you've got to change things like radios, for example, may not necessarily tune on the right thing. That's a fairly easy one to do. And you also have to look at insurance. So some insurance companies get a little bit thingy about it because, you know, replacement parts and so on aren't as easy to get. So there's a whole bunch of different factors like that. As I said, the big positive, they're generally cheaper. So, yeah, you can look at private imports or grey imports, sorry, for that sort of thing. But the two that stand out is the Kia Carnival by a mile. The Kia Carnival's a terrific car and it's got 8 seats. And it's There's a heap of them on the market. So, yeah, I'd be starting there. And the other one, the Hyundai Stario, is also pretty cool, but I'd stick the Kia ahead of it just slightly.
Okay. Alrighty, John from Traralgon. G'day, John. Hi, John.
G'day. I just wanted to ask about Toby about the new Triton. Has he driven it?
I have, yeah, Mitsubishi Triton. So it went from being, you know, the previous Triton was getting pretty old. It was smaller than the main competitors, and it was feeling a bit tired. The new one has addressed pretty much all those issues. So it's far bigger. It's far more convincing inside. It's got some different features that work quite nicely. So, for example, in the rear seat, instead of having your air vents down in the center between the sort of between the front seats down low, the air vents are actually in the roof. So it's so the rear people get better access to air on their face, which is quite nice. And the features, the safety features, it gets the 5-star NCAP rating, all that sort of stuff. So it's really stepped up from that perspective. The engine is only okay. It's nothing special. And things like the stop-start system, so when you come to a set of lights and it shuts down the engine momentarily, it's a little bit clunky in terms of the way it gets going. But in terms of comfort, in terms of driving, all that stuff, it is up there with, I think the Ford Ranger is, or the Ford Ranger and the Volkswagen Amarok, same basic car, are still leading in that regard, but the Triton is well up there as well. So it's, huge step up from where it was, and now playing with the big boys in that ute segment.
Mm. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, John. And if you would like to ask Toby a question, he will answer it if you send him a note at advice@evcentral.com.au. Honestly, says Robin, honestly, Toby, what do you reckon about BYD cars? Any good or not?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, BYD in Australia last year sold around about 12,500 cars, something like that.
What have they got? They've got the Dolphin and the Atto, isn't it?
Dolphin, Atto 3 and the Seal. So the Dolphin's a hatchback. Mm. The Atto 3 is a compact SUV and the Seal is a mid-size sedan. Mm. So, but they've got, so I interviewed the local boss at BYD a week or so ago, and they've got another three cars, I think it is, coming this year, and they are planning 4 to 5 all-new models for the next 2 or 3 years. So in terms of growth, they're saying they're going to double their sales this year, double their sales again next year, and potentially double the year after, which if you do the sums, takes them to about 100,000 sales. And to put that in perspective, Toyota sells 220,000 cars. The second best seller is about 110.
Okay. Let's bring some other listeners in and join up with our truly national audience here on the program.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
And this is Nightlife. We're in an edition of Motor Talk with Toby Hagen. Give us a call, 1-300-800-222. Line's free if you want to grab one, 1-300-800-222. Text on 0467-922-702. Your dad's called in.
Cool.
Will Hagen has texted in. Hi, Will. How are you? I hope everything is well. Will says the Austin X6 Tasman was the cheaper of the two models. The Kimberley was the luxury model. Had bucket seats instead of bench front seats and a luxury interior, 2 carburetors and 4 headlights.
There you go.
Wow.
Technology.
It was the world's first car with a... It was the world's first car with a transverse 6-cylinder engine. There you go.
Yeah, cool.
Hmm. Thanks, Will. Hi, Toby. I drove a Polestar 2 today, hired it, and it's a brand new. It was brand new. I couldn't seem to change it without downloading an app anywhere in Adelaide. Sorry, I couldn't seem to charge it.
Yeah, that's right.
Without downloading an app anywhere in Adelaide. Is that the same across the country? You have to give your details and credit card info in an app to charge an EV?
Yeah, it's
And secondly, I eventually worked out the charging cam was not working after 2 hours and a lot of driving around. Not thrilled.
Yeah.
But the car is very good on corners around the Adelaide Hills wineries.
Yeah, that's right. No, Polestars are cool. The Polestar 2 is a great car. But, charging is a pain. Charging an EV publicly is a bit of a pain to the point where you actually need a minimum of 2 or 3 apps, more like 6 or 8 if you want to cover off all of them. I think it's Evie, one of the bigger networks, they're trialing at some of their sites a fairly simple thing here that you might have noticed in service stations where you swipe your credit card and it allows you to pay. So you'd think that'd be the easier way to go. But almost all of them, you need to download apps, you need to activate the charge through that app, and you need to have all your details on there in terms of credit card details and so on. So, I've got a whole bunch on my phone that that allow me to charge them all, but
people are nervous about this and don't like doing it. I mean, I get that.
The industry has to fix that charging issue. So I spent some time driving an EV around Japan, and it's far easier there. So you've got like an RFID card, just a credit card type thing, and you can swipe it on any of their charge stations, and it works across the whole lot. In Australia, we have this clunky system where you need all these different apps, and it's a pain. So something needs to be fixed with that. I believe they are looking into it. They're trying to sort that out, but at the moment it is a pain. But hopefully they can get it sorted.
The Polestar 2, okay or not?
Polestar 2 is great, yeah. Like it goes up against the Tesla Model 3. If you line them up side by side, the Tesla wins on a whole bunch of different things in terms of range, value, space, things like that. But where the Polestar fights back is it feels like a proper luxury car. It feels upmarket and classy inside, whereas some people don't like what the Tesla looks like. So, the Polestar is great from that perspective. And the latest model, so they switched from front-wheel drive to rear-wheel drive, which in ICE cars, in petrol and diesel cars, is a very hard thing to do. In EVs, it's a lot easier. So that one shift transformed that car. It turned it into a really, really good thing.
Okay. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Mitch from the Gold Coast. G'day, Mitch.
Yes, sir.
Hello. What's your question, Mitch?
Mate, 2018 RS3 Audi versus a Tesla electronic. What's your opinion?
So you're looking obviously at a newer Tesla, given they didn't have the Model 3 here in 2018. But
yeah, correct. But I was considering purchasing a Tesla at that point in time, and it wasn't available, so I had to go to the Audi.
Yeah. Look, an RS3 is obviously a fairly high performance car. Cool little, they do a hatchback and a sedan, but great sound, all that sort of stuff. Obviously, with the Tesla, you're not going to get any of that. But what you will get with the Tesla, if you go for the performance model, the top of the range one, is you're going to get something that accelerates faster, up to 100 kilometres an hour at that initial acceleration. Where the Audi will tend to fight back is in terms of dynamics. So in terms of cornering dynamics, in terms of if you ever want to go and have a bit of fun on a racetrack, the Audi would likely be the better contender around that track in terms of a more polished all-rounder. The Tesla's a bit of a one-trick pony in terms of acceleration off the line. So it depends a bit on your priorities, I guess. I would be more than happy in the Tesla in terms of that initial performance, the technology and so on in it, which as I said, is ahead of the Audi. But, you're looking at two pretty good cars. They're two awesome bits of gear, but for me, I'd be switching a little bit to the Tesla.
Okay. There you go, Mitch.
Yeah, I genuinely appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
No worries, Mitch. Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. David from Lidcombe. G'day, David.
Hello.
Hi.
Evening, gents. Fixed price servicing regimes on new cars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you don't follow them, like they give a 6-month interval, the manufacturers give a 12-month interval, does that void your warranty if you don't do it every 6 months when they recommend it?
Yeah, potentially. So first up, no car makers that I'm aware of call it fixed price servicing, and the ACCC doesn't like that. They end up calling it cap price servicing. Now, the reality is...
Correct, yes.
It is fixed price because basically by calling it cap price, they're saying if any dealer wants to charge less, they can just never charge over that. The reality is no dealers charge less. So effectively it's fixed price, but as I said, they tend to refer to it as cap price for that reason. So in terms of, and the cap price servicing and the service intervals are independent of each other. So cars for decades have had service intervals. And the short story is, yes, if you don't hit those service intervals, then you theoretically, or in some instances, you can void the warranty. Now, it would depend on the thing that's failed. So for example, if something like a headlight failed, then that's not a serviceable item, and you'd think that would be covered even if you hadn't had it serviced at the normal points. But if an engine, if you have an engine issue and you haven't serviced it and obviously changed the oil when it's supposed to be changed, then absolutely they can turn around and say, this is an issue with the warranty. And keep in mind, a lot of the modern engines, so particularly turbo diesels or turbo anything, turbo engines do not like stretched service intervals. So if it says 6 months or 12 months, make sure you're at the very least throwing fresh oil at it, at the service interval because, they don't really like it. But another issue you got is Toyota, for example, on its four-wheel drives and utes, they tend to have six-month service intervals, which is designed for people who are using those cars off-road and for heavy-duty towing and all that sort of stuff. If you're just trundling around town and not doing big kilometres, it can be a bit of a pain having to get it serviced every 6 months, but I would still absolutely do it to protect your warranty and still do it for longevity and resale value and everything. So, yeah, definitely do it.
Okay.
I've got every intention of maintaining it correctly because it's a Corolla GR.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. High performance one.
But as you say, 6 months, it's like far too often.
Yeah, it's a bit frustrating.
Like 12 months, 10,000 Ks. I'm not even doing 5 at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it is frustrating, but I would, for two reasons, as I said, the first is your warranty, but the second one is resale. So you'll find that some dealerships, particularly the big name brands, if you go to trade that car in a couple of years and you don't have the service history, some of them are just going to turn it away, or they'll offer you, or they'll lowball you and just wholesale the car. They won't end up selling it themselves. So yeah, at the very least, from a resale perspective, I'd be spending that extra few hundred bucks each 6 months to get it done.
Thanks, David. Brett from Coffs Harbour. G'day, Brett.
Oh, good evening. How are you?
Very, very well, thanks.
David, just got a question for you. I'm driving a 2010 Fiesta, the Econetic model, a diesel.
Mm-hmm.
It's only got about 135,000 on the clock. I bought it brand new.
Mm.
So I'm hoping I'm going to get at least another 5 years or so from that, hopefully more. But I would like to get an EV as the next car. And I'm just wondering, is there a general thing you would recommend you look for in an EV? Is it range? Is it the size of the motor? Or is it a bit too hard to call in that sense?
So, it sort of depends on your priorities a little bit. But size of the motor, wouldn't even bother. Basically, there's the electric motors, everything's got decent performance in the EV world. And in terms of size, it's a little bit tricky to work out because, they quote power and torque figures, and that'll give you a rough idea of the broad size. A bigger one's obviously going to put out more. But in terms of there's not something easy like the litres of an engine. It just purely
basically, all electric motors are good.
Yeah, and and it's funny, you can get, often there's limiting factors with an EV. One is the motor, how much the motor can produce in terms of power and torque. But the other one is the inverter, so how quickly it can supply the electricity, and the battery. So if the battery and the inverter can't supply enough electricity, then the motor is never going to make more power than it's limited by the battery and the inverter, basically. So so there's a whole bunch of factors. So the things I'll be looking for, your most expensive component is battery. So have a look at the battery capacity and the range. It'll give you an idea of how far you can go between charges. But there are some people who don't need 500 or 600 k's of range. They're more than happy with 400 or 350. And so maybe not a major issue for them. But look, I wouldn't be treating it any differently to any other car. Look at the car holistically and say, okay, how much, what are you getting in the car from a value perspective? What's the performance like? What's the feature set like? And chucking all those things into the mix and working out which one stands out for you, basically.
Mm.
Right. Okay.
But other things to keep in mind as well is charge speed. So so not so much AC charging, your slow charging at home. Most of them are fairly similar on that, and most people park them overnight, so it's not a major issue if it takes 6 hours or 8 hours. But things like the AC charge rate. So if you do a lot of road trips, for example, the DC charge rate, the fast charging rate, if you're doing road trips regularly, you want to make sure that you can pile a fair bit of electricity in there relatively quickly. So, that's another one to look for as well.
Okay, then. All right. No, thank you. Yeah, because as I said, I just want to get everything lined up when this one does go, but hopefully that'll be a few years.
Yeah, you should. If it hasn't got big Ks on it, you should be fine. You should get many more kilometres out of it.
Thanks, Brett.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222. A few text questions here too. Great show, says Warren. Toby, looking for an affordable small EV. Is the Mitsubishi EKC EV maybe later this year worth considering?
EKC. This is the K car, the little tiny one.
The little K, yeah, the little tiny one. Yeah.
Well, so the issue it's got is they've had issues with safety with that car. So they're basically, a lot of people look at the NCAP ratings, your five-star yeah. NCAP ratings. This one's looking like getting 3 stars rather than 5. So they're basically saying if we do this car, and I don't think they've actually 100% confirmed it yet, but if they do it, it's going to have a lower safety rating. The big thing for that will be price. So it's one of these so-called K cars in Japan. So the KEI is, they're effectively narrow and tall. Mm-hmm. And if it comes in extremely cheaply, then it might be worth considering. I haven't driven one yet, but for me, it'll purely come down to price on that car because it lacks, I guess, a bit of wow and fizz. It's really going to have to make up for it in being affordable.
Yeah.
So okay. the other ones I touched on earlier, the cheapest EV, 36 grand, is the GWM Aura. And probably the best one at this stage is the MG4, which is $39,990 drive away. Right. So that's, in terms of that affordable, relatively affordable at the moment, that's the one that stands out. But there's a lot more coming. There's other stuff coming, you know, in the next year or two, we're expecting a few to be possibly in the low $30,000 mark.
They're coming down. They are.
Mm.
Yep. Rodney from Robertson. G'day, Rod.
How are you, Toby and Phil?
Well, thanks, Rod. What's your question?
The question is, when Toby was speaking to the guy from BYD, did he talk at all about the four-wheel drive they're bringing out supposedly this year? And the RF cards are already available for EV chargers, and I think NRMA and somebody else is just about to do it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you can get RFID cards, but you've got to apply for them and get them sent out.
I just pick one up at the electric show, EV, and you come home and you type your number into the...
And off you go.
And it worked fine. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Cool.
Really easy.
Yeah, good.
All right, I'm doing that then. In terms of BYD, so he didn't go into specifics about every single model that they'd be getting, but he did say we want to cover off every segment of the market. So, and I specifically asked, I said, what about four-wheel drives, Land Cruiser market, and, you know, Prado market, that sort of thing, and he's... nodded, said yes, absolutely. So they are looking to do that. I wasn't aware of that happening this year, but I think in the next 18 months, 2 years, you can absolutely expect them to have something in that segment. So, and look, it's worth pointing out too, so BYD at the moment only sells full battery electric vehicles in Australia, but in China, they sort of market themselves as new energy vehicles, so plug-in hybrids as well as EVs. And they've got a ute coming out. It's likely to be called the Shark, and that ute will be a plug-in hybrid. So that's one of them. And they've also got another car called the CLU, which is another one that they're looking to do as a full as a plug-in hybrid as well. So yeah,
I did hear about the Shark coming to Australia in a plug-in hybrid this year.
Mm.
And a full EV version next year. That's what I've seen on social media, but whether it's true or not, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the feeling, is they've certainly said in the past that they're going to do a full EV version of that car. So, but I also think they've said, when we talked about ute capability early on, people saying, you know, I guess the ute segment has gravitated towards 3.5-ton towing capability, and BYD sort of hinted that EV version probably won't have that. It'll probably be more like 3-ton towing. But so it may make some compromises along the way. And, you know, I've touched on this previously. The ute segment, the heavy-duty towing, is perhaps the biggest challenge for EVs at the moment. It's not going to get solved in the next year or two.
No.
I think it will in the next 5 or so. But yeah, it's a bit of a challenge at this stage.
Righto.
The Rivian's supposed to be able to tow 5-ton.
Yeah, absolutely. The big American pickup trucks.
Yeah.
The electric American pickup trucks, there's, I think Chevy promised one, Chevy Silverado EV, they promised one that could do 9-ton towing. So huge. And I actually got a ride in that Chevy EV over in New York a few weeks ago. So they're all impressive, all those big electric utes. But as I said, the towing and everything, the range you get when you're towing is the challenge. Not so much the ability to tow it, it's how far will it go in towing that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Rod. 1-300-800-222. Gil says, enjoy the show. I'm about to purchase either a Ford Ranger VS Sport or a VW Amarok V6 style, but I can't make up my mind as they're both good utes. Which of the two models is the better ute? Aren't they the same ute? Pretty much.
So, yeah, you don't want to say this to Volkswagen. They get a bit grumpy, but... But yes, they share underpinnings. So they share the same architecture. They use the same engines, the same transmissions. Where they differ is in some models with the suspension tune. So there are subtle differences with the suspension tune. Inside, there are quite significant differences to the presentation, to the finishes, the materials, particularly the seats in the Volkswagen. You notice the seats are quite different to the Ford to sit in. They sort of cuddle you or hug you a bit better. So there are differences, and yeah, I mean, for me, as I said, there's a lot of stuff shared. So to be coming down to the features for the money you're paying in terms of which one lines up best there, and also that interior.
What do you reckon?
I would tend a tiny bit towards the Fords because the last time I lined them up value wise, they were a fraction ahead.
Okay.
The Volkswagens tend to get more features, though. You tend to get a bit more equipment in them.
More fruit, as they say.
Yeah, more fruit. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, but they both drive really well. Volkswagen's doing a bit of a push on Amaroks at the moment. So, if you can get a decent deal, absolutely.
Go with it. You don't say who you are, but Phil, what are Toby's ideas on a first girl's car, roughly 15 to 16K for my niece?
So I'm assuming this is second hand because there's not a whole lot in the 15 to 16 grand.
Yeah, the second hand.
New market. Mm-hmm. So look, stick with your mainstream Asian brands and try and buy as new as possible. So, and if you don't need size, I mean, the smaller the better, basically, because you'll end up getting potentially more features in there for a similar amount of money. But, something like a Kia Cerato is a good place to start. So 7-year warranty on it, and it's, if you get one that's a few years old, you'll still have some factory warranty backup. Mazda 3s, there are plenty of Mazda 3s kicking around on the used car market that have worked really nicely. Who else? Hyundai, you could go to a small SUV such as a Hyundai Venue or a Hyundai Kona would be also good, and the Hyundai i30 as well is also worth looking at. So I'd be looking at those sorts of things. Honda has some terrific cars too. You could get a Honda Jazz, for example, which is a great little car that'd do a nice job. So, yeah, something like that would be cool.
Okay. John in Geelong, this is the compulsory Land Cruiser question, which we haven't had recently.
I was just wondering, what sort of engines do the Land Cruiser come in now?
Only one. So it's a 3.3 litre twin turbo V6 diesel. So
yeah, but I heard the utes are 2.8 litre.
So, okay.
And V8 still.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess I assumed you were talking about Land Cruiser wagons, so the more traditional luxury Land Cruiser. They also do the Land Cruiser 70 series, the utilitarian boxy-looking thing. So that one gets the old V8, which is the 4.5 litre single turbo in that car, single turbo V8. Or if you want more grunt, you get the 4-cylinder, which is the 2.8 litre 4-cylinder turbo diesel. Same engine used in a Toyota Prado, a Toyota Hilux, Fortuna, what else? Yeah. Hiace. So they spread that engine far and wide. So it depends which Land Cruiser you're going for. If you're going for that trucky utilitarian one, then you get the choice between the 4-cylinder and the V8. If you're going for the wagon, the more luxury wagon, then it's the V6 twin turbo.
Yeah. I heard that the V8 is 4-year order and they're not ordering anymore.
So it's not quite 4-year order. I actually popped into a dealer about 6 or 8 weeks ago and I said, what are your wait lists like on it? And he pointed to one in the showroom and said, you can have that one now if you want it. Basically, he had one sitting there. So you can sort of find them here and there. But yes, there have been, they closed the order books on V8 Land Cruisers 18 months ago, somewhere around there. They have not reopened them and I don't think they're going to reopen them because the expectation is that engine will probably get killed off probably next year, possibly earlier. And they've still got enough orders in the bank to try and fulfill the planned production that they've got. So there's a fair bit going on in that segment, but I wouldn't expect those orders on a V8 to open up. But it wasn't my understanding; it wasn't a 4-year wait list because, as I said, they closed the order books. But if you sniff around, you can occasionally find one.
Sure. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Bye. 1-300-800-222. Someone's sniffing me for saying girl's car. That wasn't me. It was the questioner. Use the link. Peter from Willoughby. Thanks for raising this, Peter, but I don't want to go any further on. Toby, any chance of getting an EV with a spare tyre now in the future?
Yes. So the...
Hang on. What?
The Cherry Emoda EV, which goes on sale in the next couple of months,
has got a spare
tyre. Will have a full-size spare tyre.
Hooray.
The Hyundai Kona Hybrid definitely has one. I think the Kona Electric also has a Space Saver spare. I'm pretty sure the Kona Electric's got a Space Saver spare. So you'll start seeing more of this. I mean, keep in mind where the focus has been for EVs from the manufacturers. It's been on the sweet spot of the market, predominantly around town running, and it's, you know, they haven't prioritised, globally, they haven't prioritised spare wheels, as Australians love. But you will absolutely see them, particularly once you start seeing utes and once you start seeing proper four-wheel drives, you'll definitely start seeing more full-size spare tyres. But you know, the challenge they've got is fitting them in. And you've got a fairly big battery pack, usually about half a tonne of batteries sitting in the floor of the car. So yeah, something's got to give. But as battery technology gets better, as the energy density improves, then obviously that gives them more flexibility to potentially put a spare tyre in.
Mm. Rightio, Ron from Newcastle. G'day, Ron.
G'day, Toby.
Yep. Yeah, g'day, Ron. What's your question?
Has Toby had anything to do with ceramic paint treatment?
Yeah, I have. I actually had a car done years ago. I'm not sure I'd rush back to it. And for me, as to whether I was going to do it again, it would depend on how I was going to treat that car. If I was parking it on the street regularly under trees and so on, where you get bird poo and sap and that sort of stuff, I'd probably consider it. And I've got some mates in the industry who swear by it. They think it's terrific. But, you know, keep in mind you're paying sort of $1,500 or so, sometimes more, to get it done. So it's not a cheap process. Yeah. And if you ultimately, if you wash the car, if you care for the car, if you wax it regularly, I think you can get similar results. But, yeah, it can also do a good job in terms of keeping that rubbish off, particularly if you don't look after the car.
Okay. All right. The other question I had was a Forester, top of the range. What do you think?
Subaru Forester?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. In that mid-sized SUV segment, it's the only one really that does some semi-decent off-roading, and it's a very convincing package all round. But that market's extremely competitive. Toyota RAV4 hybrid's still very good. The Nissan X-Trail's terrific. Kia Sportage is great as well.
All right, Ron, some thoughts for you. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Gee, time's flown. It's gone. Toby, terrific to talk, as always. Keep on the straight and narrow. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
Good on you. Toby Hagan with another edition of Motor Talk. Thanks for your calls. Sorry if we didn't get to everybody. We tried.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.